Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Howdy, Mark Kenny here with another Democracy Sausage coming to you from the ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy and the Australian Studies Institute. I don't know about you, but I think there was a real sense of the penny dropping in the last week or so as it becomes clear that all the optimism, the talk of snapbacks and of bridges to the other side was revealed for what it is, wishful thinking, nostalgia, and in some cases, simple misdirection. After all, there are many things about our political economy that we should not even aspire to go back to, like heavy air pollution, time-wasting traffic jams, endemic unaddressed homelessness, chronic underemployment, the gender wage gap, the miserable, unconscionably low dole, and of course, failed environmental policies. There are many things we need to improve, obviously. Even so, I think it's becoming clear now that the economic damage of this crisis is deeper, longer, and more structurally transformative than any recession in living memory. In the past week, companies like Qantas, Myer, the big accounting consultancies, Microsoft, and others have realised they will be both smaller and different in coming years, permanently changed. The government's economic team of ministers and officials is meeting almost daily to design its policy response in light of the commitment to withdraw JobKeeper and JobSeeker in 3 months' time. Nobody believes the so-called cliff is either economically or politically advisable, but what comes in its place? And when will we know? Certainty is as scarce as economic growth itself, it seems, so many employers are saying the sooner the better. With me to discuss the issues is Dr. Maria Taflaga, lecturer and political scientist at the School of Politics and International Relations. Maria, hi there. Do you get the sense that the coalition now realises it can't go much further without setting out the future of its COVID assistance?
Yeah, I think the government has kind of been aware of this for some time. And as we have sort of discussed over these past weeks and months, often with a rather gloomy tone, I think they're essentially trying to build space for themselves, to give themselves the capacity to be flexible, which is sort of why a lot of what they say at the moment is quite vague, which is why they sort of lean on, well, we're waiting on this report, or, you know, we've set a deadline of reporting in July, so on and so forth. And part of this is, you know, simply a political management exercise. And part of it is, you know, sound public policy. We don't necessarily want governments making very rash decisions, particularly if they don't have good information. I mean, I think JobKeeper is a really good example of this, right? You know, like there's been a fair bit of criticism about JobKeeper being, you know, $1,500 for every single individual. But effectively what Treasury did was trade off efficiency for rapidity, right? And so you have to make these kinds of trade-offs. And now we're in a situation where everyone kind of knows, for example, that construction will be impacted, but we don't really know what the precise outcome on or what the precise impact on construction will be. We know it's kind of coming. We know it's coming sort of next year. And so that actually gives government time to plan. There are other sectors of the economy where it's already clearer what the impacts are. And, you know, that's sort of a location for government to start sort of planning sooner. But I just don't think that it is fair or even reasonable to criticize governments for actually wanting to think things through. Yes, we can always have a go at them for, you know, not always being upfront about what's going on. And of course, they have a confidence game to manage as well because they don't want to talk down the economy. But, you know, like part of it is like if you actually want good policy processes, well, you can't rush them.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point about having a bit of time and using that time to get it right. Also with us is Professor Frank Yotso, who is a director of, or is the director of, the Centre for Climate and Energy Policy at the Crawford School of Public Policy. Frank, welcome to the barbecue area. What did you make of Labor's olive branch on energy policy last week? Was it meaningful or gestural or neither?
Yeah, hi, Mark. Well, look, if it is a step or a possibility for bipartisanship on climate and energy policy in Australia, then that's a wonderful thing, right? I do have my doubts as to whether we can possibly get there because really, you know, the climate wars have been going on for a very long time. There is unfortunately still political capital to be made for some out of keeping those conflicts going. And really, you know, when you look at the policy ecosystem, what matters now really is the recession, is the health and, you know, the pandemic in general. And so you're not really expecting that this government in this term of parliament will make climate change a priority, very unfortunately, right? And so when you take that to its logical conclusion, then this could very well mean that the Labour Party, in fact, is, deliberately or inadvertently kind of beating a tactical retreat on this for the time being by saying that they're kind of willing to strike a compromise, and that implies striking a compromise at a relatively low level of ambition. That would be my impression of where this lies, but who knows how it'll turn out.
Yes, we might be risking, as I think you've pointed out in a piece in The Conversation, risking bipartisan inaction as much as we're moving to a period of bipartisan action. So I guess that's a real risk. And it's also a warm welcome back to a great friend of Democracy Sausage and a doyen of the Parliamentary Press Gallery, Sky News chief anchor, the redoubtable Kieran Gilbert. How are you, Kieran?
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, well.
And Kieran, what's your impression on the matter Frank was just talking about, the Anthony Albanese's olive branch on energy policy? Do you think it was sort of simple tactics? Was it a wedge?
Look, I think it'd be lovely if it was a genuine olive branch, but I think it was tactics. It's basically to try and neutralise this issue which has bedeviled Labor for a long time. And they can't do anything, you know, substantive on this issue if they're not on the Treasury benches. They can't do it unless they win. So to try and neutralise this issue, just look at the leader and the climate spokesperson, both of the left, both very strong and committed believers in dealing with climate change and the climate crisis. So this to me is tactical. It's to try and neutralise as best they can to say, look, we're trying to be bipartisan. We're trying to just get beyond this period of, a diabolical period of public policy that we've seen over the last decade. But there is a cohort within the coalition that are never going to accept compromise. We saw that with the National Energy Guarantee, which they proposed and they didn't accept. Yeah. They weren't going to let it fly. So I think Albanese, Butler, they know that there's a cohort within the coalition that aren't going to accept any compromise. So whatever they offered was not going to be received, willingly by the coalition. So I think, it's tactics to try and neutralise this issue, and they'll revisit when they're in office if they win the next election.
Yes, Maria, it's really a well-commented, well-trod ground, this problem of the climate wars, of there being very little progress. What can voters do to make sense of this impasse? When you think about it, the main players, the two major parties, are not only against what their opponents put forward, they're against what they themselves have put forward in the past. So if you think of Labor, they're no longer for an ETS that they backed. They're no longer for a carbon tax that they backed. They're no longer for an emissions intensity scheme that they backed. You look at the Coalition, it was pro-ETS to begin with in the dying days of Howard. It was pro-direct action. It was pro-NEG. I mean, the National Energy Guarantee was the brainchild of the current Treasurer when he was Energy Minister to Malcolm Turnbull, Energy and Resources Minister. How can voters make any sense of this? You've got the parties implacably opposed to each other and implacably opposed to doing anything else, it seems.
I think voters do have a good sense of what has gone on here. I mean, this is just a catastrophic public policy failure systemically over a really long period of time. And I guess what is actually kind of ironic is that we have sort of like stepped down through increasingly, I guess, less necessarily straightforward options on climate change. But the reality is that just like the names of these policies keep changing or their so-called emphasis keeps changing. I mean, now we talk a lot about energy policy, securing our energy policy, securing our energy grid, cheap energy for the future. But this is this, you know, I mean, the whole point of Turnbull's National Energy Guarantee was a way of securing a mechanism to deal with pricing carbon in effect by another name. And I guess what is important for listeners to understand is that the way we talk about climate change in Australia is actually fairly unique across the world, right? Like it is often framed in terms of believers and non-believers rather than a series of economic choices that we make about our future. I think one of the biggest problems about the way we talk about climate change in this country is that we never talk about it in terms of opportunity costs. You know, it's always exactly what we'll be sacrificing of our current lifestyles, assuming that what we are currently doing in our economy right now is actually sustainable. When most experts sort of agree that that is not the case, and most businesses are pushing the government to do something in this space. And I think that's the reality, is that that constituency, that business constituency, is constantly pushing for some certainty around this because they need that. And yes, there is this core group within the Coalition in which coal is, you know, it's tied to what they perceive are the jobs in their community. It's tied to where they get donations from. And part of it is just almost like a cultural identity marker. But this problem isn't going away. And eventually some kind of crash through compromise will be reached because it will simply be necessary. It will simply be no longer sustainable to continue like this.
Frank Godsoe, that's a very good point that Maria makes, isn't it, about consistency. That is essentially what the larger business community is looking for, some sort of sense of bipartisanship to remove the sovereign risk associated with investing. Is that, even if there are shortcomings in it, is that the virtue of what Anthony Albanese was proposing, that there be at least some sort of, you know, agreement on the framework? And if Labor were to get in, it can sort of ratchet up the ambition, but the framework for the rules is agreed across the political divide, thus removing the giant and very real risk that's been a factor for years now of an election coming along and wiping the slate clean all the time.
That's right. I mean, investment uncertainty that comes from policy uncertainty is really what has crippled the energy industry in Australia for a very long time now. Right? And this goes back, actually well over a decade now. The compromise really fell apart, or the hope for compromise fell apart in 2009. And since then, it's been stop-start, right? We've had a series of governments that, try to make believe as if, you know, no change was going to come. But industry can't believe that because the technologies change, right? And the imperative to get global greenhouse gas emissions under control is there, right? There was a real shift with the Paris Paris Agreement in 2015, what we hear from boardrooms is that there is now a clear recognition that long term, this is a problem that humanity will tackle one way or another. And so, you know, boardrooms want ultimately to see investments that are compatible with that long-term Paris Agreement ambition of arresting global warming, right? But Australian federal policy just simply doesn't reflect that. And that's where you've got that constant friction, really, between what governments say may or may not happen and what industry believes must happen in the long term. Now, What Labor proposed there, you know, on the face of it, is absolutely the right thing. Agree on a framework that is flexible enough to provide some ambition and to accommodate different levels of targets, right? And so that is the kind of model that you find in countries that are actually making substantial progress on climate change, UK, Germany, a few others, right? There, it's not in political contention as to whether you know, there's a shift in the economy towards low carbon. The political contest is over exactly how to do it and how fast to go. That's where we should get to. And that's, you know, on the face of it, what Labour proposed. But, you know, I mean, there's every reason for doubting that we can, in fact, get there at this point in time in Australia, unfortunately.
I think one of the points on the international scene that needs to – we need to factor in the current – context is the looming presidential election. If Joe Biden wins, and the reason I'm making this point is because of its flow-on effects for our government's approach. If Biden wins, you get this massive shift in the United States. The one of the behemoth entities in that Paris deal is back, and it will be a constructive force. There's that component. The other major long-standing ally of Australia is very, very forceful in its commitment to Paris, and also is the host of the next COP in Glasgow, and that's Boris Johnson, the British government, a Tory government. So this Morrison government is going to be feeling pressure internationally like it hasn't for, you know, the coalition hasn't for a long, long time. I would argue probably since the Paris deal was signed. And with Johnson wanting a substantive deal and ambition revised and set in this next COP in Glasgow, plus you've got in the White House, you know, we looking at the polls, if you can believe them, obviously, you take them with a grain of salt given the result last time, but Biden is ahead in all the swing states. And if he wins, they're back in Paris. And they're back to being a constructive player. So I think that international element, which has been probably a negative in terms of, you know, the Trump impact and its impact on Australia, is going to be a positive impact then. And Morrison will find himself having to move.
We talked a lot after the election about Scott Morrison's authority because he'd won an election that he wasn't meant to win. He'd done it largely off his own bat, you know, sort of powered by preternatural self-belief and God, apparently. And he'd taken over a party that had divested itself of those big lions of division, Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott. Do you think that nonetheless, notwithstanding all of that authority, and it is quite, you know, it's a much more peaceful government than it has been at any time, really, in its entire 7 years of occupying the space. Do you think, nonetheless, that Morrison doesn't have the power to, for example, consider what Labor's proposing in the climate space? In other words, if he was to say, yes, let's sit down, let's end this climate war, let's agree at least on a framework, would the sort of climate recalcitrants arc up?
No, I think that was it. He's pragmatic enough to do it, first of all. Secondly, I think he's got the political capital to do it. Yes, he does. And thirdly, some of those individuals who arced up were really doing it as a stalking horse to get Turnbull. I mean, it wasn't – for a number of those people, it wasn't about climate. It wasn't about the neg. It was just about getting Turnbull.
And they saw it as Turnbull sort of reverting to type, you know, that he was essentially exactly. a greenie in liberal clothes, and that he was promoting something that they had forsworn, not, you know, him not doing essentially as part of the deal to give him the leadership back in 2015. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. What's your view on that, Maria?
Oh, I do think that a large degree of the internal climate politics within the coalition was driven by resistance to Turnbull. And that is the argument that Turnbull makes, I think, fairly persuasively in his recent autobiography. I guess, Kieran, as someone who actually has access to these actors, like, what are the internal discussions amongst, I guess, the sort of more climate progressives within the party? Like, is there a recognition towards the top of government, you know, that some kind of accommodation will need to be made, even if it's, you know, given another, you know, euphemistic name?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think there is. And in the context of not just the domestic situation, like I mentioned earlier, they're going to – I don't see a situation where they can maintain the use of the Kyoto carryover credits. That's something which has been ridiculed internationally. So I think there's a recognition both on that side of the international frame, but also – domestically, that they are being mugged by reality. Basically, as Frank said earlier, there's the technology story, there's the business story, there's the finance story. It's all heading in one direction, and it's not where the dinosaurs might hope it is.
Frank Yotso, what about the technology roadmap that the government's unveiled? Does that offer any hope?
Yes, it does. So the process that's been kicked off, to my mind, is a good one because it's one of analysis and consultation. There's a foreshadowed annual review of technology priorities and all of that. This is the kind of process you'd put in place if you were serious about actually tackling that, right? The question now is, of course, what role will it actually be given in a policy process? And crucially, what kind of resourcing and policy support will actually be provided once the handful of priority technologies will be identified, right, sometime later this year? There's both scenarios. At one end of the spectrum would be to just use it as a fig leaf, right? Government have already said that the technology roadmap and the national priority statement will be the cornerstone of the national long-term low-emission strategy, which Australia will be required to submit at the next UN climate conference, right? So you could do that and you could say, here we have five long-term technology areas that we hope and expect will deliver in coming decades, and that's it, right? And that'll give you an excuse for not doing much at all in the short to medium term. Or you could actually go and make a serious effort in research, in development, and in deployment of zero-carbon technologies and position the country that way, position Australia's economy to be a large-scale energy exporter and resource exporter in a zero-carbon world, right? But that, that latter one will actually mean a substantial commitment, right? It won't do to just allocate a few more billion dollars to ARENA and CEF's Clean Energy Finance Corporation, right? That kind of thing spells investments of tens of billions per year. And that's where we'd need to get to. I'm not quite sure that we're there yet. But equally, if we leave this hanging for another decade or so, then we'll miss that train.
Frank, can I ask, given this is your field, I mean, there's a lot of talk in, I guess, the sort of more pro-climate media that Australia is missing its opportunity to be a green energy superpower, as a hard-headed economist. Mm. Like, how realistic is this prospect of us being a green energy superpower? Is this something we really should be aiming for?
Well, we have the comparative advantage for it, right? Because we've got a lot of land mass, we've got a lot of, sunshine, and we've got, the track record in establishing large resource-based exports industries, including processing, like the LNG industry, right? And we're perceived to be a very stable place politically and institutionally, right? And so that puts us in a very favorable position for establishing these kinds of externally oriented industries compared to most other countries. The question is, of course, whether the cost advantage that we will have in Australia because of cheap renewable energy, cheap land, opportunity to build large-scale industries, where that cost advantage will outweigh the transportation costs, right? Because, yeah, I mean, renewable energy will also be cheap in Japan and Korea. Okay, not quite as cheap because, yeah, land is more expensive and sun doesn't shine quite as much. And so that's really the balance in the end. And there is, of course, also a chicken and egg situation, right? So you will get the economies of scale where you're going to put the large investments. And that becomes, you know, from a purely economic point of view, a really interesting issue of timing, right? So when's the right time to strike and establish an industry like that and establish a center of gravity and become a major player? Now, just to finish off on that, in terms of, in a public discourse, it's often talked about hydrogen being that Australian energy superpower future. The closer we look at that, and we've got a big program of research at that at ANU, right? And the closer we look at that, the more it becomes apparent that it's probably the fuels and the products higher up the value chain that provide the biggest chance for Australia to be a major player in zero carbon energy and resources exports. So, for example, turn the hydrogen into ammonia and then export that ammonia. So that's much easier to process for export and much cheaper to transport than hydrogen itself, potentially establish a steel industry in Australia that uses hydrogen and that is zero emissions and then export that so-called green steel to the world. This is extra attractive because it would mean substantial amount of value added within the country. But, you know, that's a multi-decadal proposition. We're talking more, you know, 2040s and beyond rather than before.
Yeah, well, it's nonetheless a pretty exciting prospect too. The actual idea of doing something here, of creating jobs here, of elaborately transforming things here, it's perhaps coming back into vogue now. Look, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll look a bit more at some new research that you, Frank, have out about how we can stimulate the economy and how we go about selecting the projects and the programs that actually will deliver for the country in both an economic sense and in other ways as well. So back in just a moment.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
All right, welcome back. Now, just before we go on to Frank Yotso's recent research paper, just continuing on this green energy issue for a moment longer, I'm wondering if I could just get a response from all three of you about the issue that we've all seen remarked upon in the political discussion in recent times, and that is the sense that governments through the COVID crisis have been listening to experts. They've been listening to science, listening to the medical evidence and using it to guide their policy. You know, the great hope is, of course, the great parallel that's obviously drawn is that is so much what is needed in climate change and energy policy. Should we be optimistic? Perhaps I'll start with you, Kieran. Do you think we should be optimistic that governments have kind of learned something here and may behave differently?
Yeah, I think there is a source for optimism on this. And the reason – well, first of all, we've seen the very public presence of the likes of Dr. Brendan Murphy, Paul Kelly, Nick Coatsworth, the chief and deputy chief medical officers, and – They have underpinned, their panel of experts have underpinned basically the leaders' moves on every front. And except for this most recent spike in Melbourne, things seem to be, you know, we seem to be world leading on that front.
And as we're recording now, you were just pointing out there's another 75 cases, infections that have been identified in Victoria. Now, they are going through a massive testing program at the moment, but that's a considerable uptick in numbers.
It's the largest, for a number of months. I think that we'll end up seeing a shutdown of those suburbs in the northern part of Melbourne as a result of that. But the other component why I'm a bit optimistic off the back of this national cabinet experiment, which has proven successful, is that what it does is also elevate the state Liberal governments, and in that I'm thinking the Marshall government, South Australia, the Berejiklian government. And by doing that, you've got much more realistic, pragmatic views on climate. So I think that there will be an extension, whether it's immediate. As I said before, Scott Morrison is pragmatic. He does have a lot of political capital. I think there will be a gradual move to some more substantive policy on this front, and largely because of that state component as well. You've got all the states committed to net zero emissions by 2050. Matt Keane in New South Wales, very progressive on this front. Front running in a big way. So I think that for a number of reasons, this is a good, and hopefully lasting step towards understanding, accepting science, letting it guide public policy.
Maria?
Oh, I'm slightly more pessimistic, I guess, partially because I think it's always easier for, well, anyone really, to trust medical advice because it's sort of existential to life. I mean, I don't doubt that most of the climate deniers within the coalition party room, for example, also very happy to listen to their GP or cardiologist in terms of in terms of their physical health. I mean, the reason why climate science is harder to manage there. Oh, sorry, my dog is also wanting to participate in this conversation.
No, he's very welcome.
The other, I'm keep patting you. Sorry. The other reason why climate science is far more contestable, not contestable is the right word. It's that climate action requires restructuring the economy. It requires restructuring effectively how a society relates to government. And that means big losers, people who are very powerful. And I do think Kieran's point about state Liberal premiers is a good one because you're right. Like there is, I guess, a sort of greater kind of realism there. And that's perhaps potentially because, you know, they're also managing water, which is a significant area of political upheaval, you know, what we sort of forget about in the cities. But, you know, in the last New South Wales election, both seats that surround the Menindee Lakes were lost to the National Party, right? And handed over to the farmer shooters and fishers. And, you know, we saw big swings at the last election. And the reality is for these communities, none of these issues have gone away. They are acute. As we go back to summer, some of the preoccupations of bushfires, of water scarcity, of, you know, the very visible signs of the frailty of the environmental system upon which we live will likely come closer to front and centre. And so, you know, I guess I'm not necessarily convinced that governments will necessarily want to listen to scientific advice, but the politics of the situation might create an opportunity for a pragmatist like Scott Morrison to act in a way that is palatable enough to his recalcitrants and just enough to convince a electorate that doesn't really want to spend much per person to do something about climate change.
Well, Frank, I think you'd probably say that at least we've seen from politicians in this COVID crisis, not just the public policy value of following scientific advice, of evidence-based policy and the like, but the political protection that comes from it. Is there something at least in that for governments making a shift in climate policy?
Yeah, I think there is. And I also think that in this context, it's really important to think about what happened with the bushfires, right? So it's really not that long ago then that we thought that the defining event of 2020 was the bushfires, right? In a nutshell, I would characterize it like this. What came out of that was a very clear acknowledgement from this conservative government that climate change is real and that climate change poses a big problem to Australia and that we need to respond to that problem, right? But that response is largely framed in terms of disaster risk management and in precautionary measures to deal with climate change, right? Rather than Australia really putting shoulder to the wheel to help the world reduce emissions and thereby limit the extent of future climate change, right? So in a sense, it's a shift from climate denialism to climate action denialism. Okay. And that's a much, much harder thing to deal with because, you know, that's where a renewed trust in science doesn't actually help you that much because the problem as it is framed is one of economics and the problem as it ultimately arises is one of vested interests and a reluctance to embrace change, right? There's a lot of, you know, Maria mentioned it before, there's a lot of very powerful and influential and well-resourced players that have a lot to lose from a faster transition away from fossil fuels, and that's what's playing out. I mean, this is not unique, of course, to climate change, right? This is what's happening in any, it's what happens in any major economic industrial transformation, but this is a really big one, right? And one that to an extent will be policy driven. And so it's extremely contested in that way. And it also comes back to a regional element here, right? So the potential losers are very heavily concentrated in particular areas of the country, right? The Hunter Valley in New South Wales, central Queensland, right? And so you've got marginal electorates. You've got very visible impacts on local communities, on unemployment, on livelihoods, and that plays out very strongly in the political process. And, you know, that newfound trust in science, I fear, doesn't really help us overcome that particular hurdle.
That's slightly depressing, but I guess very hard to argue with. Look, now let's shift to another area, which is related more to the economic crisis that we're in at the moment and the health crisis too. Frank, you've recently released a research paper with some colleagues in which you advocate using this moment to achieve twin objectives of stimulating the economy but also improving the economy, improving our society, including, I guess, energy and climate performance, but probably in some other areas as well. So can you just very briefly outline what it is that your research paper does? You know, it sets out criteria for evaluating options for stimulus spending.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mark. And so really, you know, this working paper that a group of my colleagues and myself released recently at Crawford School here is, we're really just talking common sense here, right? So we're saying, so governments collectively, federal and state, right, are about to put a few billion dollars on the table for infrastructure stimulus investment, right? So this was always on the cards that we would shift from business support and income support for the short to medium term to more direct government investment activities, you know, as we're realizing that it's not an immediate bounce back or V-shaped recovery economically, right? So this is, you know, I mean, this is not new. This is classic Keynesian stimulus spending. This is what was done in many, many countries, including Australia in 2009 during the global financial crisis. Okay. So the question then is what do you want to achieve here? And for, you know, the answer unanimously will be jobs, 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 right? And Prime Minister made it very clear that that is his government's vision, right? But of course, you know, you can create jobs in many different ways, right? So, you know, Keynes at the time said the easiest way to create jobs is for government to send out one team of people to dig holes, right? And then to send out another team of people to fill them in again, right? But you can do a lot better than that. You can actually create value for the future, right? And you can create positive social outcomes. You can create positive environmental outcomes. And really, you know, what we've done here is bring together through a fairly exhaustive literature review as to what different organizations are saying about that and what kind of criteria you can distill, right? And then, you know, on the basis of these criteria, you can identify some broad areas of infrastructure investment that would in general do well on that kind of set of criteria.
Kieran, we've been down this road before, as Frank was just saying, it wasn't that long ago. It's amazing to think in our careers that we've sort of so quickly experienced the GFC and all the sort of, you know, juddering changes in policy that that brought about. And then, you know, a dozen years later, we're in an even more dramatic situation. And of course, the objective, even back in 2008, 9, 10, was about those twin objectives that Frank's talking about, simulating for the purpose of, you know, revving up the economy, creating jobs, but also delivering value. Now, that was strongly behind Julia Gillard's School Halls program. It was strongly behind the blighted Pink Bats home insulation program. So these things can go well, but they can also go awry. I personally wouldn't put the School Halls program in the awry category. I think it was an extraordinarily good program. But nonetheless, this is a well-traveled road, isn't it? And it carries some risks for government.
Yeah, it does. But just to go to this back to something Frank said earlier, because I want to touch on this in the context of this argument and the paper that Frank's done on the need for a green-led recovery, essentially in layman's terms. Because the reason I'm optimistic about it is because while there are those obstacles in, say, the Hunter or Central Queensland in a political sense, the overwhelming momentum in terms of finance, I think, and it's not just academic research. To just this week, we've got Beyond Zero Emissions being launched, a 1 million job project with Mike Cannon-Brookes launching it from Atlassian, and Christiana Figueres is the architect of the Paris Climate Agreement, also involved in this, an Australian initiative to create 1 million jobs in this space. So I don't think the legacy industries are – they're not operating in a vacuum. Now, while they've been successful at this point, I think we might be very close – to a tipping point here, and this crisis is responding to it, recovering from it. There's momentum towards a green-led recovery, not just in Australia but around the world, and with the likes of Atlassian founder Cannon-Brookes and this Million Jobs project. I think that there's a real commercial heft coming behind the sort of argument that Frank made a bit earlier.
Kieran, can I ask, who is the government listening to? I mean, obviously the kitchen cabinet is sort of highly influential. You know, the treasurer himself is an important architect of the NEG, for example. I mean, you know, is there that appetite within, I guess, the government at these sort of higher circles to sort of engage in this, or really will it turn on whether or not there is a political consideration that this will be good politics? And therefore, then we will get this outcome.
Oh, no, look, I think that, as I said repeatedly, the Prime Minister's not an ideologue on this. He's a pragmatist, actually, across the board in terms of his politics. You could say the same of Josh Frydenberg. So the two most senior individuals want to get some progress. They know there's been a stalemate, that it's hurt investment and energy investment certainty. In recent years, they're well aware of that. Josh Frydenberg went through a hell of a time when the NEG was knocked over. He was very, very
knocked over himself. Really,
he was knocked over himself, and but also in a political sense, felt like it was a huge loss for him. But at the time, I mean, he's recovered obviously in a political and personal sense. But that was tough for him. I think that they will try and look for an avenue where they can get some progress. And as I said before, they've got the political capital and they've got the crisis within which to get something done.
That's a very good point, yeah. Frank, what do you think an infrastructure project, just to get sort of more specific about it, what should an infrastructure project deliver? Because you can make a case that just about building anything creates jobs in the process of building it. But what are the kind of criteria that you think could be applied to projects to deliver long-term benefits and also to avoid, I guess, falling into the trap of something like the home insulation program, which had a whole lot of unintended consequences, really.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's obviously a whole range of objectives, and you will want to evaluate them in a so-called multi-criteria analysis, right? So you'll definitely want the jobs, right? And you'll want ideally some lasting economic benefits, some productivity benefits, right? Make the economy work better, create the kind of investment that will get us on a better economic trajectory, right? That will create business opportunities in years and decades to come, right? You have the opportunity to achieve social goals, right? So, for example, supporting marginalized communities, supporting low-income earners, supporting regions of the country that are doing it particularly tough, right? You can, with some projects, you may be able to harness local environmental benefits. And, you know, you can make a very clear argument that this is the opportunity to put in place things in abroad, right, that support the transition to a really low carbon economy, right? And the first obvious thing there is to avoid investment that actually lock in the opposite, that lock in high carbon investments, right? And so on that list, right, broadly speaking, you've got all kinds of renewable energy investment. So what we've seen in the last 2-3 years is an enormous boom in wind and solar installations, including large scale. Wonderful thing, Australia, really among the major countries, has the highest per capita installation rate of wind and solar, okay, per capita. But obviously, you know, with a recession coming, there's every risk that this investment pipeline will tail off, dry up maybe even, right?
So this crisis is, in a sense, a chance to do what the market has failed to do in terms of the overall energy policy framework, but also to pick up some of that that drop off, to compensate for some of that drop off as a result of just a recession.
Yeah, precisely. So that's how you'd think about it. You know, the last few years we've had a certain amount of annual investment in renewables. It would in many ways be a real shame to let that drop off again, because the industry is geared up to do that. It's really clear that, you know, these are economically sensible investments for the long term, and so out of that arises an argument for government. Yeah, and it's more likely state than federal governments to just simply, you know, support that pipeline through government contracts, right? Could even be built on a government's books and privatized later, right? You can think of many different models. But, you know, I mean, you've touched on pink bats already, and, you know, these are sort of the scheme back in 2009 for home insulation, ceiling insulation in particular. These are very classic areas where you can do stimulus spending quickly and effectively, right? Because you're not subject to long-term approval processes. You don't have kind of locations that are in a stick somewhere, right? You can do this everywhere, and you can do it in a way that very easily builds on the available building industry capacity. So, pink bats,
and it's
really
quite good in that sense too, because it can be quite diffuse. You can put money into the hands of lots of people, lots of tradies, lots of companies at the same time, and so you're getting quite a good diffusion of economic activity right across.
That's right. And what you'd like to see, though, is energy efficiency in the broad, right? So that can be different kinds of insulation. That can be better windows and doors, that can be a shift from gas heating to electric heating, high efficiency stuff, that kind of thing, right? And you don't need to do that in a sort of a state-run program like the Rudd government did at the time. And, you know, what really sort of, you know, led to that those huge problems in terms of lives lost with the Pink Bats program. You can leave that to private industry. And, you know, when you just want to contrast that, a government is actually going there with this home builder program, right, subsidies for home renovations and home building. They want to support the building and industry and the tradies, right? I mean, yeah, you can ask whether that's actually strictly necessary compared to other areas of the economy that do need perhaps the stimulus more badly. But if you're going to go there, right, by just giving money to people who already have renovations underway or planned, and by giving it to people without any kind of prescription of objectives, right, you're really missing out on a lot of benefit that could be had, right? If conversely, you put $1 billion or $10 billion into improvement, you know, energetic improvement of public buildings and public housing, right, then you'd achieve a real benefit socially by cutting the energy bills and improving living conditions for those on low incomes, and by cutting the energy bills of state and local governments into the future. So that's the kind of public benefit that you'd really want, right, out of expenditure of public money.
One of the other things, of course, that would be good to see done, I think there's pretty much universal agreement on this across the big business and peak organizations representing big business, market economists, welfare agencies, pretty well everyone except the federal government at the moment, and we're not sure what their position is going to be as a result of this, but you can tell where I'm going here. I'm talking about increasing the unemployment benefit. At the moment, we know, of course, it's called Job Seeker, and it is effectively the doubled New Start allowance. All the talk is a lot of speculation about what happens when Job Seeker comes to the end in September 30. Does it remain? Does it get phased out? Is there a compromise position where people are getting more? That's obviously one way of providing quite significant cash stimulus to the economy, yeah, because people who are reliant on that level of income, they're not savers, they're spenders.
Yeah. Well, my understanding of what they're looking at the moment, there were reports in the last few days suggesting there'd be a permanent increase to Newstart, and there might be down the track, but my understanding is in July when the Treasurer hands down that statement that it's more – it'll again be a temporary move. So the $150 a week increase that was reported, that figure is not right. It's going to be
– I think it was $150 a fortnight.
$150 a fortnight. Okay. Yeah. Well, that figure's not accurate. It's going to be temporary as well. It's not a permanent. So I think that we probably see a more generous but temporary measure on July 23rd. And, you know, I don't want to be fulsome in my praise for Josh Frydenberg, but I think that's the right way to go right now, because we don't know how deep, how long. I mean, it looks like it's going to be a long, long time that we're going to have double-digit unemployment or near to it. But I think it makes sense to give it another 6 months or so with an increase in a temporary framework, and then obviously they can't go back to what Job Seeker was, the dole.
No.
For so many reasons.
It's unconscionable.
It's unconscionable. It's also the economics of it makes zero sense.
Yeah.
And there are going to be so many more Australians relying on that next year. But I think when you're
and
looking at
it – makes zero political sense too.
It does. It does.
And because I think of that number.
Yeah. If you're looking at a permanent change, the earliest I would see it happening is October with the budget. More likely the next budget come early next year, but I can't see them going back. It won't go back to what it was. It's just untenable.
Yeah, we're getting very close to time here, but I'll just get a comment from both Maria and Frank, perhaps you first, Maria, on that whole – on the politics and economics of the dole.
Well, I guess I concur with what Kieran said and just sort of underline the point that the rate of New Start was not only cruel, shameful, and completely
punitive.
Against the consensus of virtually every single interest group. I mean, you know, apart from the general reasons why we have welfare states, the way that it reflects on our society about how we look after our most vulnerable, even if those arguments aren't persuasive to you, business has been advocating for many years now about the fact that you can't get a job on Newstart. You can't buy shoes. You can't look presentable for an interview.
Yeah, and I would just add, look, remind ourselves that we are one of the highest income countries in the world, right? And we do, in general, take a little bit of pride on how we run this society and, unemployment benefits or, in general, social security payments at the level that they have been are just not compatible, right, with what we can do and what we collectively actually want to see for this country. And it's also just simply economic madness to be pushing people into poverty that way.
Yes, we'll wind up on that note. Look, just before we go, I might just point out that another colleague of ours, also a visiting fellow at the Crawford School of Public Policy, Peter Martin, has a piece in The Conversation as we record today, this being Monday, where he's it's a regular series, but they've surveyed 22 economists, The Conversation has, in 16 universities. And it makes for very good reading, but it's obviously it's quite depressing reading because these economists are predicting a very dire economic situation going forward. It's I guess a fair bit worse, and that goes to my comments at the beginning of this podcast that there's a real sense now that we're entering a quite a hard stage. We're talking about unemployment, as we just have around, you know, in double digits, peaking in double digits, and still being 7%, according to most economists, by the end of 2021, with wages still flat. We're talking about China shrinking by 2.3% this year and perhaps growing by as much as 4% next year, which is not bad. But really, you know, with the Prime Minister stating back in some weeks ago that Australia has a plan to try and grow at 1% above trend, but, you know, to 2025 in order to sort of grow its way out of this, that's going to be extremely difficult when you look at the global forces here, the downturn being so universal around the world, and, of course, Australia being so latched in to the international economy as a big exporter. Look, thanks very much for your time today. Frank, can I just get you to say where people can read your pieces? You had one in The Conversation, and they can, if people are interested in reading your research paper, where they can find that?
Oh, yeah, thank you very much. So just Google my name. That should do the trick. Other than that, on the website of the Center for Climate and Energy Policy at ANU Crawford School, you will find all of these materials, research papers and links to op-eds, et cetera, collected in there. The website of the Center for Climate and Energy Policy at Crawford School. Thank you.
So thank you to Professor Frank Gotso. Thanks to Sky News Chief Anchor Kieran Gilbert, and of course to Maria Teflaga, who's with me each week on this podcast. We'll look forward to talking to you again later in the week. And until then, bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks very much. Great to chat.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.